Welcome to Pancreatic Cancer Update. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. I met with Dr. Michael Pishvian, and to begin, I asked him to comment on what he sees as the key features of the biology of pancreatic cancer.
So there's a lot to unpackage there, and I think one thing that's important about pancreatic cancer is that we've come to a new era where 10 years ago we had basically one therapy, gemcitabine, that didn't work all that well, and the variability in patient outcomes was fairly narrow. But now with FOLFIRINOX and gem-nab-paclitaxel, and also, as you mentioned, with additional target therapies, that variability is starting to spread out, and it's helping us to understand that patients do respond differently to different therapies. What the underlying reasons for that still remains to be completely elucidated. The biology of the cancer in of itself, I think the first most important thing is the nature of the fact that it spreads, it metastasizes so quickly, so early. And I tell my patients that even a 1 centimeter node negative tumor that is resected still has a very high likelihood of coming back with metastatic disease. So we know that these cancers spread very early. As you suggested, the tumor deposits themselves have a lot of stroma that makes delivery of chemotherapy, but also infiltration of things like immune effector cells very limited. So treating the cancer is difficult in and of itself.
Could I just ask what the current thinking is of why you see this desmoplastic reaction?
There's a lot of work trying to understand that. The pancreatic cancer cells and also the neighboring stroma, there's definitely an interplay between them, the result of which is additional stromal tissue and additional stromal cells that further enhance the stromal tissue. There's no doubt that the stromal cells play a very active role in the development of a pancreatic tumor above and beyond the actual cancerous epithelial cells.
So focusing more, obviously, there's been a lot of work done throughout oncology nowadays looking at genomic variables, and you've been very involved with this, and there are multiple really interesting initiatives that you're involved with right now trying to look at this. At this point, what do we know about that? And particularly, we're hearing more and more, and you were nice enough to participate in a symposium. We had multiple people with different tumor interests, and this concept of DNA repair deficiency. How does that fit in right now with this vision you have?
I definitely integrate it as an important part of the care for pancreatic cancer patients. The overarching picture is that we know that about 25% of pancreatic cancers, and that number, that percentage of 25% has been consistent across multiple publications. We actually counted one day, it's probably well over 5,000 patients that have been studied independently. And generally speaking, about 25% of pancreatic cancer tumors harbor what we call actionable mutations, where there are different mutations that are driving the cancers. There's a few important categories. One important category is really coming to light are the KRAS wild-type pancreatic cancers, which represent about 5% of pancreatic cancers. There was one recent big publication that had the percentage up to 12%, but that's probably a little bit overstated. So somewhere in the 5 to 10% range. And these KRAS wild-type tumors clearly have other drivers, fusion genes that are often very targetable, things like BRAF mutations, but also NTRK fusions, FGFR fusions, et cetera. So identifying even KRAS wild-type tumors is a window or a door into looking for other actionable drivers. But as you mentioned, the most common subgroup, representing probably about 17% of all pancreatic cancers, are those with some degree of DNA damage response and repair deficiency. This is best known for the BRCA mutations, but actually BRCA mutations only make up about 3 to 5% of pancreatic cancers. ATM mutations are actually the most common DNA damage response and repair mutations, making up about 6%. And then there's a whole slew of 1% or less of genes that are mutated throughout the DNA damage response and repair pathway that probably have different degrees of responsiveness to both platinum-based therapies and also some of the newer therapies like PARP inhibitors and other DNA damage repair inhibitors. So I think that there's a tremendous amount to learn and to study, and I think identifying these patients and getting them on different therapies, particularly in the context of clinical trials, so we can understand which drugs work best based on which mutations is going to be really critical. One other thing I would mention, that pancreatic cancer still remains different from other cancers. So a BRCA-mutated, even a germline BRCA-mutated pancreatic cancer, unfortunately, is still less easy to treat than a germline mutated ovarian cancer or breast cancer, for reasons that we still don't fully understand. But you can treat, as you probably know better than I do, you can treat a BRCA-mutated ovarian cancer and sometimes have a very long, sustained, complete response to single-agent PARP inhibitor. In pancreatic cancer, you occasionally have that success, but for the most part, you get a partial response that lasts at best a year or so before the cancer starts to become resistant.
So I want to get your practical take for a doc in community-based practice in terms of, you know, how to approach this diagnostically. But before we get into that, one other sort of genomic variation, I'm curious how it fits in and how practical it is the issue about MSI. How often do you see that in pancreas? And again, have you had patients who respond to checkpoint inhibitors?
Yeah. Unfortunately, it's really, really uncommon. It's probably on the order of about 0.5 to 0.7% of all pancreatic cancers. Of course, there's some variability across different studies, but in our Know Your Tumor program, that's about the percentage that we saw. And out of about 1,000 patients, we've seen, I think, 3 MSI-high pancreatic cancers. They do respond. The one publication that's out there, Young Lee's work that she published in Science, she had 6 pancreatic cancer MSI-high patients. And if you look at the graphs, per RECIST criteria, 4 responded. But if you look at the graphs, actually all of the patients had their tumors shrink. Just 2 of them didn't technically meet the criteria of RECIST response. So I think MSI-high tumors respond robustly to immunotherapy like they do in other cancers. But it's just a very, very uncommon finding in pancreatic cancer.
So I want to explore a little bit some of the practical issues involved in sort of genomic profiling, but, you know, sort of broadly for docs in practice, I mean, you have liquid assays and you have tissue-based assays, multiplex assays, particularly NGS. Can you talk a little bit about, first of all, what you recommend? At what point in time, obviously in a patient who, you know, has a better performance status, who's starting to get beyond, for example, approved therapies, and maybe even earlier, what would you recommend as a strategic approach to genomic testing?
There's definitely been a lot of change. Even since the last time we talked in March, there's already been changes in this paradigm and in the recommendations. I'll start with germline testing because in 2018, last summer, the NCCN recommended germline testing for every pancreatic cancer adenocarcinoma, irrespective of stage. So even resectable pancreatic cancers, we recommend germline testing. And that has much to do with identifying patients who harbor germline mutations because of implications to family members. Because as it turns out, even for patients who have known BRCA gene mutations, germline BRCA mutations, when you look at their family history, as much as 40 to 50% of those patients actually have no real discernible family history that would have prompted you to do germline testing. And more recently, some of the work being done out of Hopkins and Mayo, they're finding that doing surveillance screening, if you will, for patients who harbor germline mutations, surveillance for the development of pancreatic cancer, it does tend to find the cancers earlier, and the cure rate for the patients who are under aggressive screening actually is very, very high. So there's a lot of justification for finding the patients, for finding their family members, and for screening. So to answer your question, I actually am now at the point where every pancreatic cancer patient that I see at my first visit, I initiate germline testing for them. That's tough because there are limitations on the system. So if a patient has germline testing and a germline inherited mutation is identified, they definitely need to be seen by a genetic counselor who has the wherewithal to really sit down with the family and talk about the implications of that result.
Well, one of the things that you hear in ovarian cancer, I think actually came out of that symposium you were involved with, is the question of if there's no family issues or if the patient or family doesn't want to get involved with family issues, do you lose anything by just going to NGS?
There are situations where the NGS of the tumor doesn't pick up the full breadth of mutations that may have otherwise been captured on germline mutations. It's getting better. The MGS panels are getting broader and more extensive, but there are some NGS panels that actually will miss some of the foundational germline mutations.
So everybody gets germline testing. What about somatic testing?
Right. So then in 2019, in April 2019, the NCCN followed up their recommendations and recommended that the way they worded it is that all patients with advanced disease who would be candidates for other therapies should also get somatic testing. In truth, that probably represents 80 to 90% of all pancreatic cancers because of the nature of the disease. So we do also recommend somatic testing for patients. It does take a little while, and so I don't usually wait for first-line therapy. What I'll do is I'll start these patients on either FOLFIRINOX or gemcitabine nab-paclitaxel or a clinical trial if I have it available, but then concurrently I'm getting tissue and sending that off for somatic testing. As far as the panels go, the panels have become commoditized and they're becoming more and more similar, and there are excellent panels that are out there. And I really sort of use what the institution recommends, but several of the retail testing companies, really any of them, have good testing platforms for somatic testing. And then you ask about liquid biopsies too. What we found in a small study that we did, and I think this has been seen in other studies, is that liquid testing is very specific, but not so sensitive. So if you find a mutation through liquid testing, you can count on it as a legitimate mutation, but you can also miss, you can have a lot of false negatives just because of the inadequacy of the testing. What I would say is if a tumor sample is available, I prefer to use tumor somatic testing. But if there's no tumor sample available, then I do revert to blood-based testing.
So I want to kind of get into some of the nitty-gritty, maybe going through some of your cases that really have targeted therapy of pancreatic cancer, but I also want to ask you whether there are any new data sets that are going to come out that you're looking forward to see.
I do know of a few key findings that are coming out in the next few months. I'll plug our data that I know that from the Know Your Tumor program, we're now well over 1,000 pancreatic cancer patients. We actually presented this in poster form, in abstract form, at ASCO, and we'll be following this up with a publication. But we do have a broader sense of what the mutational profile is for the pancreatic cancer patients, and we're starting to see indications that if patients get tested and then they get put on the appropriately targeted therapy as defined by the testing, that their survival is actually increased compared to patients who get tested but aren't able to go on the appropriate profile testing. I also happen to know that the IMPACT study from Memorial Sloan Kettering, Eileen O'Reilly's group, is really looking deep into their set of, again, well over 1,000 pancreatic cancer patients. I think they're over 1,500 now. And they're really going into the nitty-gritty of the specific mutations and looking at prognostic and predictive variables. And I think that'll be a very rich resource.
So for the doc who, you know, has a patient, you know, there are plenty of patients out there kind of getting beyond or quickly get beyond approved therapies. The patient may wish to look at some experimental approach. Targeted therapy would be very attractive, I think, to a lot of patients. For practical purposes, you mentioned the Know Your Tumor program. You mentioned the Memorial program. What are the options if a doc in practice wants to sort of plug in to one of these trials? What are the ones that are available right now?
That's an important point. There's not enough available, and it's a little bit frustrating. I mean, for my pancreatic cancer patients, if I can't get them off label therapy, I'd prefer to put them on a trial. So if I can't put them on a trial, I do try and get off label therapy. But in reality, some of these therapies aren't even approved yet. They're only in clinical trials. And so we're sending them often to phase one trials that happen to use the drugs that we're trying to use, you know, PARP inhibitors, ATR inhibitors, et cetera, but in the context of clinical trials. So having an access to, having your finger on the pulse of the phase one trials that are out there is one approach and can be very difficult. Even for me, I'm often on the computer searching clinicaltrials.gov, even for trials at my own institution. Companies, I'd say, generally speaking, particularly when we talk about the PARP inhibitors, there's now 5 approved PARP inhibitors, and for the most part, they've been pretty good about giving access to drugs when you ask the company. Insurance may not be approving it yet, and generally they aren't, but the companies are pretty good about giving access to the drugs, and we do hope that we're going to see an actual approval of a PARP inhibitor in the coming months for pancreatic cancer.
And we want to go through the data that's supporting that because it's obviously really important to know about. But why don't we start out with a couple of patients and I think certainly the majority or a lot of the interest in terms of targeted therapy is in PARP inhibitors. So you've got a couple of patients who are actually part of trials. How about this 62-year-old lady who, I guess, presented with metastatic disease? What happened there?
So she was interesting. Her brother had breast cancer, so male breast cancer, in the mid-2000s, and that prompted the family to initiate testing. And so she knew she had a BRCA2 gene mutation, a germline mutation, long before she developed pancreatic cancer. Unfortunately, there was no real screening paradigm, and when she presented with typical symptoms of pancreatic cancer, abdominal pain, et cetera, she was evaluated, thought to have an operable tumor, but intraoperatively, unfortunately, had a intraoperatively biopsy-proven metastasis. So they didn't operate, but after she recovered from therapy, we actually happened to have a clinical trial available with a combination of chemotherapy and a PARP inhibitor, FOLFOX and veliparib. And she went on therapy, and she actually was able to stay on therapy for nearly 14 months. She actually had a very robust response. Her disease almost completely disappeared. There was just the slightest sliver of tumor available. Her quality of life was essentially normal during the time that she was on therapy. And her response, her outcome was fairly typical of a BRCA mutated patient who's able to get on PARP inhibitor-based therapy. Now, unfortunately, her ultimate outcome was also typical in that she did eventually develop resistance to therapy and her cancer progressed and we needed to resort to other standard therapies for pancreatic cancer.
Just out of curiosity, what other therapies did she receive and what's her current status?
It's interesting. She actually received gemcitabine nab-paclitaxel as second-line therapy, did not really respond at all. And then she was able to, I think she actually came down to Houston and was put on a phase one immunotherapy trial. And she was responding, surprisingly, to the immunotherapy. She actually developed cholecystitis that ended up becoming septic and passed from the cholecystitis, but at a time when her cancer was actually responding. I mention immunotherapy because there is a body of literature to suggest that patients with underlying DNA damage response and repair mutations, there may be a similar degree of mutational load that we see with the MSI high patients that may lead to an increased responsiveness to immune checkpoint inhibitors. But that's still very much being studied and yet to be defined.
Now, when you say she got immunotherapy, was it a checkpoint inhibitor?
It was a checkpoint inhibitor with, I believe, a CSF1R antagonist as well.
Hmm.
It was a combination immunotherapy study.
So she got veliparib, she got a PARP inhibitor, but she also got FOLFOX. So I guess it's kind of hard to separate that out. And, you know, we haven't seen much data in general in other cancers of combining PARP inhibitors with chemotherapy. Veliparib is the one that you hear about. Can you talk a little bit about what we know about this strategy in pancreatic cancer, combining PARP inhibitor, particularly veliparib, with chemotherapy?
Yeah, so it really goes to the underlying way in which these different PARP inhibitors work. So most of the PARP inhibitors, olaparib, niraparib, talazoparib, rucaparib, they all have a broader mechanism of action where they induce what's called PARP trapping. And essentially, that allows those drugs to act as more than just PARP inhibitors. In many ways, they act similar to chemotherapies, and they're much, much more potent as PARP inhibitors. Now, that also leads to a greater degree of myelosuppression. And it's been the myelosuppression that has really limited the ability to combine one of those PARP inhibitors with chemotherapy, be it platinum or non-platinum-based chemotherapy. There have been multiple studies that have been done with olaparib and others with chemotherapy that's just really been too toxic. And so some of those studies are being redone with much lower doses of the PARP inhibitors, but we don't really have any data yet. And I certainly wouldn't suggest combining one of the standard PARP inhibitors, one of the now approved PARP inhibitors, with any kind of chemotherapy because the safety data just doesn't exist. Veliparib does not cause PARP trapping, and so there's much less myelosuppression, which many people are concerned it reduces the efficacy, but it does also open the door up to combining it with chemotherapy. And so there may be synergy to a non-PARP trapping drug like veliparib with chemotherapy.
In general, what's your level of enthusiasm for this strategy based on these early data that we've been seeing?
For veliparib specifically or just PARP inhibitors in general?
PARP inhibitors with chemo combined.
I think it's a valuable strategy. I think that the experience that I've had with veliparib and FOLFOX, I definitely feel like the veliparib has added to the FOLFOX. Now, I don't know that from a data perspective, and Dr. O'Reilly has a randomized trial of GemCis plus minus veliparib that's going to read out in early 2020, so that'll be very important. But I do think that there is some synergy there, and so I think strategies that try and use lower doses or different schedules of the approved PARP inhibitors with chemotherapy do really need to be flushed out.
You have another patient, 62 years old, with metastatic disease, but this patient got monotherapy, something, you know, you more typically maybe that you might consider in a community-based setting.
So actually, I just got an email from her. She's doing really fantastic. So she was a patient, and again, speaks to why we should do the germline testing. She was a patient with metastatic pancreatic cancer at presentation, had really no family history at all. And we started her on FOLFIRINOX because she was fairly robust and able to tolerate it. And in the process of taking care of her, we also initiated testing, and she ended up having a BRCA2 gene mutation. We've subsequently done germline mutation. She actually doesn't harbor a germline mutation, only a somatic mutation. So she got 8 cycles of FOLFIRINOX and did well, responded partially to chemotherapy, but of course was getting a little bit beat up by the FOLFIRINOX. And fortunately, my colleague up at UPenn, Kim Rice-Binder, had this rucaparib maintenance trial, and we were able to get her up there. And that was more than a year ago, where she was enrolled in the rucaparib study. She's had essentially a complete response to therapy with really no visible disease, and her quality of life is completely normal, and she continues to do excellent.
So just to clarify, though, she didn't progress on the FOLFIRINOX?
No, and that's really the underlying pinning of the quote-unquote maintenance strategy, where non-progressors on platinum are put on PARP inhibitors if they have a germline or somatic BRCA mutation, and they seem to do really, really well. And in fact, actually, patients who frankly progressed on platinum, they don't respond to PARP inhibitors. There have been a few publications, including Roshna Shroff's RUKA-PANK study, clearly showed that platinum progressors don't respond to PARP inhibitors.
You know, it's really interesting. We got into this in that AACR multi-tumor symposium, how just because of the way the trials were set up, you see a very different paradigm, for example, in breast cancer than ovarian cancer. Ovarian cancer has this platinum response and then PARP maintenance. And breast, they just use PARP monotherapy. And really, I don't know that they even tried that maintenance strategy. A lot of general oncologists like the maintenance strategy. They even do it in breast, even though there's no data. What are your thoughts about these two strategies?
I love the maintenance strategy personally. I think it really, in some ways it helps in pancreatic cancer, in some ways it helps select out patients who are going to benefit the most, because you allow them to get a little bit of chemotherapy, and if they're doing well, then they're going to have the benefit of time to be on a less intensive therapy like a maintenance PARP inhibitor. Quite frankly, I even tend to back down on FOLFIRINOX to maintenance capecitabine for the non-DDR mutated patients. So just the run-of-the-mill pancreatic cancer patient, if they've gotten 8 cycles of FOLFIRINOX and they're responding, I tend to back off to just 5-FU or oral capecitabine. So the maintenance strategy, I think, is an excellent one and really is the subgroup of patients that's likely to benefit the most.
So maybe you can talk a little bit about the data that we currently have. Of course, we saw the big POLO presentation, the phase 3 trial looking at this strategy. Can you talk about that study and basically what we know right now about PARP inhibitors and pancreatic cancer?
Yeah, it was a well-done study, particularly because they made a huge effort to screen over 3,000 patients across the world. And so we've learned a ton about just the identification of germline mutations in pancreatic cancers. I think one of the most interesting things to me personally is that all these presuppositions about what kind of patient most likely harbors a BRCA mutation was really thrown out the window. For example, 5% of South Koreans have germline BRCA mutations. You know, who would have thought that would have been the case? But they definitely find a broad spectrum of patient populations, demographic patient populations, that have germline BRCA mutations. As far as the design of the study, they did definitely take this maintenance approach. I think my criticism of the study is they didn't define the period of time for which the patients received the chemotherapy. They just had to have been non-progressors on platinum-based therapy. Some of the patients actually had been on platinum-based therapy for a year and a half before they rolled into this study. But nevertheless, their primary endpoint was progression-free survival, like in some of the ovarian cancer studies, and they did achieve their primary endpoint of increased progression-free survival over placebo. One other criticism about this study is that, and actually at my prior institution, we actively chose not to open the study because we just didn't feel good about putting these patients on a placebo arm after a period of induction chemotherapy with platinum-based therapy. So one of the criticisms is, would that progression-free survival difference of olaparib versus placebo been more modest if there had actually been some sort of an active chemotherapy maintenance arm, like perhaps an oral capecitabine or an IV 5-FU?
Could you talk a little bit more from a granular point of view, the specifics of the data in terms of the magnitude and also in terms of survival?
Sure. Yeah, so these, again, were germline BRCA-mutated patients, so not somatic-mutated patients. And they were on platinum-based therapy and had to be, by a very strict definition, not have progressed on prior platinum-based therapy. They were enrolled and then randomized to olaparib versus placebo. It was a 3-to-2 randomization. And the primary endpoint was progression-free survival. And if I remember the numbers correctly, the progression-free survival of olaparib was about 7.3 months, I think, versus about 3.4 months on placebo. The patients who responded while on the olaparib, now, of course, they may have been continuing to respond from their prior platinum, but nevertheless, the patients who responded often had very durable responses. And at the time that the trial was presented, there were still many patients on study continuously on olaparib, several of them with a complete response. They also looked at overall survival as a secondary endpoint. And another criticism of the study is that there was not a statistically significant improvement in overall survival. In fact, actually, the curves were pretty overlapping. But the thought was that with additional time, that especially those patients who had durable response on olaparib, that that would actually change the overall survival data in the year or two or three to come.
I'm assuming that very few of these patients crossed over to PARP inhibitors?
Some of them did. I think the number was roughly 7, which is not a huge number, but that may have influenced the treatment. The other thing that they didn't have data on is what percentage of patients went back on platinum-based therapy after they had progressed on placebo. So I think those confounding variables are going to be teased out in follow-up studies that look more closely at the overall survival outcomes.
So what about tolerability, toxicity? Obviously, we have a lot of experience with PARP inhibitors with other tumors, with olaparib, and all these agents. You hear about GI problems, you hear about cytopenias. What was seen in the POLO trial?
There was definitely toxicity issues on the olaparib, at least comparing to placebo, which again is not necessarily the most fair comparison because the tolerability to placebo was very good. But the toxicities seen with olaparib in this trial were similar to, probably a little less intense, but similar to what was seen in the ovarian and breast cancer studies with the GI toxicities that you mentioned, the myelosuppression, et cetera. Patients were able to be, the doses were able to be modified so that they were able to stay on. And I think those modifications actually helped with the tolerability.
If you had to estimate, how many patients do you think you've treated with a PARP inhibitor who had pancreatic cancer yourself?
Oh, well, I had the luxury of having a couple of trials available for these patients. So I think probably close to 100 patients in the last several years.
And any sort of anecdotal experiences you want to talk about in terms of toxicities? The ovarian people, you know, some of them use preemptive medication for GI problems. They have different approaches to cytopenias, anemia. Some of them will transfuse. Others decrease the dose. What's been your experience and how do you manage this?
Well, it's interesting. You know, most of the PARP inhibitors, including veliparib, the effective dose at inhibiting the PARP enzyme is about 5 or sometimes 10-fold lower than the dose that's actually approved for use. So I've always had the mindset that if you actually reduce the dose, you do increase tolerability, but you're probably still effectively treating the PARP enzyme in the tumor. And that has been the experience that I've had, is that patients who had GI toxicity or myelosuppression, and definitely those were the two primary side effects that I've seen, when you take them off the pills, give them a little bit of a break, allow them to recover, takes about a week or two to recover, then you put them on a lower dose, they almost always are able to tolerate a lower dose. Either one step lower or two steps lower, they're almost always able to tolerate the lower doses.
And what about cytopenias and anemia?
Same story, similar story, that they're able to recover, their bone marrow is able to recover, and when they do, if you put them on a lower dose, that tends to be not as much of a problem.
From your perspective and also other investigators, how do you see the POLO strategy right now? Should this be standard of care? Should it be approved? What would you recommend to a doc in practice?
I personally definitely think it should be approved. I think it's a strategy that works really well. We definitely, as in many areas of pancreatic cancer, we definitely have more room to grow. But the idea of being able to give patients a break off of FOLFIRINOX and put them on a pill therapy, which at least has progression-free survival proof, I think is an excellent strategy. It also gives us a window of opportunity from a clinical trial perspective to say, okay, the patient who's responding to or non-progressed on 4 months of platinum-based therapy, then you're going to put them on a PARP inhibitor if they have a BRCA mutation. Well, can you add something else to the PARP inhibitor to make it even more effective?
What's the NCCN? You know, they have various categories of recommendation. What are they saying right now about the POLO strategy?
I don't know. That's a good question. I don't know if they'll call it level one evidence because it did meet its primary endpoint, or perhaps something a little bit lower because of the lack of an overall survival endpoint. I think we'll have to wait and see about that.
Now, you mentioned the patients in the trial had germline mutations, but yet you presented this patient with a somatic mutation, and we see in other cancers, actually in ovary, you have an approval in somatic as well as germline. What do we know right now about responsiveness in general with, let's just start with somatic BRCA, and then we'll talk about other somatic alterations.
Yeah. So I think the experience is mixed. Having had conversations with my colleagues who treat a lot of BRCA-mutated pancreatic cancer patients and have had access to PARP inhibitors, I can summarize our experience, which is that the somatic mutated BRCA patients definitely do respond, but if you look at the breadth of them as a percentage, there's probably a smaller percentage of those who respond, and the duration of the response is a little bit more muted. So I definitely would treat a somatic BRCA mutated pancreatic cancer with a PARP inhibitor, but I would expect a little bit less of a response rate and a little bit less of a durability of response. That definitely needs to be teased out further in additional either registry studies or formal clinical trials.
Can I ask you kind of a conceptual point? And again, I remember this came up at the AACR meeting. I mean, people who have BRCA germline mutations, you would think, like anybody else, can get random tumors, lung cancer, colon cancer, lymphomas even. Maybe, you know, sort of over my head biologically, but would you expect them, a patient like that, to respond to PARP inhibitor?
I think we're sort of waiting to see what the data shows. There are cholangiocarcinoma patients that have been published on that have BRCA mutated tumors that do respond nicely. There's been a handful of colon cancer patients, very rare, but a handful of colon cancer patients who appear to have responded. Then there's the lung cancer patients, many of whom don't respond to either platinums or PARP inhibitor-based therapy when they have an underlying BRCA gene mutation. And the other thing that I should mention, I think that we definitely don't know yet enough about, the MSI-high patients, like again talking about the colon cancer patients, you often will get a report, an NGS report in an MSI-high cancer patient, and you'll see a BRCA mutation. And those mutations may very well be bystander mutations of the environment in which there's additional mutations because of the microsatellite instability. And in fact, it sometimes doesn't even represent the whole of the tumor, because the whole tumor may be MSI high, but portions of it may have different secondary mutations, bystander mutations, like a BRCA gene mutation. So BRCA-mutated MSI-high patients don't necessarily respond to platinums or PARP inhibitor-based therapies.
Bystander mutations, that's interesting. So is that a general concept, not just related to pancreatic cancer?
Yeah, I think so.
Huh, wow, that is really interesting. So let's finish out with targeted therapy. A couple other just real quick cases that you have here that just really look interesting. And touches into another question I had related to other germline mutations. You have a 58-year-old lady who has a germline ATM mutation. So without going through all the details of her complicated history, maybe you can just talk a little bit about, you know, what we know about these other germline mutations like ATM, particularly as it relates to PARP, and what happened with this lady. And I see right now she's on a trial with a PARP inhibitor and a, quote, ATR inhibitor.
So ATM mutations are found in about 6% of pancreatic cancers. So again, it's the most common DNA damage response and repair mutation in pancreatic cancer, but very few of them are germline ATM mutations. It's a pretty rare condition. I would say that we really don't know what the benefit of different targeted strategies are for ATM mutated tumors. You can very much lump the ATM mutation patients into having some defect in the DNA damage response and repair pathway. And so treating them with a PARP inhibitor seems logical, but the experience has been mixed. I had actually had a few patients on my FOLFOX veliparib trial that had underlying ATM mutations that did not seem to respond very well. But I've talked to my colleagues, including one published data set from Harvard, where two ATM mutated patients responded very well to PARP inhibitors. So I just think we don't really know the full breadth of responsiveness to ATM mutations. Now, ATM and ATR work together when DNA damage occurs, ATM and ATR are critical for sensing the DNA damage that occurs and initiating the process of what's called homologous recombination repair. And what has been found, at least in the laboratory, is that when ATM is deficient, is not functional, ATR makes up for a lot of the deficiency of ATM. And so when you block the ATR in addition to having ATM mutation, then you get a synthetic lethality similar to what you get when you block a PARP inhibitor and there's an underlying BRCA gene mutation. So it's hoped that by blocking ATR in an ATM deficient patient that you actually might get a more robust response to chemotherapy. And that's exactly the kind of chemotherapy trial that this patient is on currently with the irinotecan PARP inhibitor and the ATR inhibitor. I would actually almost argue that the PARP inhibitor for that particular trial may or may not be necessarily adding anything, that the majority of the work is probably being done with the irinotecan and the ATR inhibitor.
What's an ATR inhibitor?
It's a novel DNA damage repair inhibitor. There's about three out there in clinical trials right now. And again, they're blocking that additional DNA damage response pathway that ATR is critical for.
Any single agent activity?
I think there's mixed on that. I think that the activity is being seen more when being combined with other agents, including chemotherapy.
Before you started her on all those trials, she was managed, you know, using approved therapy, and I was curious about what happened. So can you talk about how did she actually present? And I'm just really curious about what happened also with the stent and the SBRT.
Yeah, so she presented, like many locally advanced pancreatic cancer patients do, with biliary obstruction and an abdominal pain. And she was pretty sick when she first presented, and we wanted to start her on chemotherapy right away. But of course, with the biliary obstruction, even though she did get stented, it takes a while for the bilirubin to normalize. And so we can't give irinotecan, we can't give gem or nab-paclitaxel with a bilirubin above 3. So she just was started on FOLFOX, which of course is perfectly safe to give essentially at any bilirubin level. And she responded so robustly, so quickly, that we just kept her on the FOLFOX. And back then, this is several years ago actually, back then we really didn't know whether we should or should not use radiation therapy. We had a pretty active SBRT program at Georgetown, and so she went ahead and got SBRT. I'm glad you brought her back up because she does have the underlying ATM mutation, which we didn't know at the time. But ATM also is a lot of literature predicting that it allows for a very robust response to radiation therapy. So that probably led to a part of the reason why she had such a long-term control of her localized disease when she got the radiation treatment.
That's interesting. So you see better response to radiation therapy. It kind of makes sense, but I'm not sure I've heard that before.
Yep, yep.
The other thing that's interesting about her is, you know, because of her bilirubin, she just got FOLFOX and not FOLFOXIRI, but yet she did really well, which I guess maybe reflects the ATM mutation?
I think so. And I think, you know, the FOLFOX certainly does have some activity. There have been some patients that didn't have underlying mutations that come in either with biliary obstruction or even those with extensive hepatic disease that have a bilirubin of 8 or 9 that's not stentable. And I've treated them with FOLFOX, and some don't do well. Some eventually just peter away, but actually some do respond enough that the intrahepatic disease allows for the bile ducts to flow. You get the bilirubin normalized, and then you can actually add irinotecan and get a full FOLFIRINOX course in these patients. So when a patient comes to the hospital and their bilirubin's 10, 12, 14, they get evaluated by GAI or interventional radiology, and they just can't quote-unquote fix them with stenting. If these are newly diagnosed, untreated patients, I actually will routinely treat them with FOLFOX rather than just saying we can't do anything for you.
Interesting, and she's a good example of what you were talking about before. She was on capecitabine maintenance for 2 years. What do you think happens in practice? Do you think people just stop the FOLFIRINOX? Do they keep 5-FU going? And if the patient's continuing to do well?
Yeah. I think, again, all of us are trained, community oncology, academic oncology, all of us see the experience of oxaliplatin neuropathy. And so very, very few patients, thankfully, continue indefinitely on oxaliplatin because of the neuropathy. What I've seen in the community is that a lot of these docs will go on to just use FOLFIRI rather than FOLFOX, especially if the patient's tolerating it adequately, which I think is a reasonable strategy. I think it's also reasonable to consider backing off to just IV 5-FU. And in fact, there was a trial done in France presented at ASCO 2018 that really clearly showed us that maintenance IV 5-FU strategy is perfectly reasonable. We in the U.S. often will adopt oral capecitabine as a substitute for IV 5-FU, and so that's why I use that approach fairly routinely.
One more thing in terms of targeted therapy is your 60-year-old man who, interestingly, has a ROS1 fusion. So can you talk about him and what happened?
Yeah. So he came to me knowing he had the ROS1 fusion at the time when we had a clinical trial available with entrectinib, which was just recently approved for NTRK fusion patients. So entrectinib also happens to target ROS1. And this patient had a ROS1 fusion that was an activating fusion, and he was able to enroll in the study. And he tolerated therapy very well, and he had a nice response to therapy for about 8 months. It wasn't all that long lasting, but he did definitely benefit from entrectinib targeting his ROS1 fusion. Interestingly, this patient subsequently went on to get a second generation ROS1 inhibitor and actually still continues to be on therapy, as far as I know, now probably more than a year on this second generation ROS1 inhibitor. And I think that speaks to the notion that his ROS1 truly is a driving mutation for his underlying cancer. So like in the lung cancer patients who get first and second and even third generation ROS1 or ALK targeted therapy, they do benefit, kind of proving the fact that that fusion is driving their tumor. ROS1 fusions are pretty rare. They're more rare than NTRK fusions for pancreatic cancer. But again, it speaks to the idea if you find it, then these patients can really benefit.
It also makes you think more and more, and also even as it relates to PARP inhibitors or DNA damage repair agents, of the sort of MSI type concept of looking for the molecular lesion and not so much focusing what the primary tumor is. Do you think that we're kind of getting there, for example, with PARP and BRCA?
I think so. I think that, you know, PARP and BRCA, MSI high and immunotherapy, NTRK fusions and larotrectinib and now entrectinib, even BRAF mutations, we're finding BRAF V600E mutations in pancreatic cancer patients who respond to typical melanoma type BRAF targeted therapy. So yeah, I do think we're getting to that point where we're having a more molecularly driven treatment plan for patients. I will modify that by saying, as I alluded to before with PARP inhibitors for pancreatic cancer, even though I think a BRCA-mutated pancreatic cancer patient should be treated with a PARP inhibitor, I also acknowledge that they don't tend to respond as well or as long as a BRCA-mutated ovarian cancer patient, for example. So biology still matters.
So I want to spend the rest of our time talking about, I guess you could say, more conventional approved type strategies, particularly for localized disease, but also metastatic disease, sort of the nitty-gritty of pancreatic cancer and medical oncology for a long time. But before we do, I just want to take a step back. I know you see lots of people who are managed in a community-based setting, managed by general medical oncologists. I'm just kind of curious, as you go through these histories, patients have been treated oftentimes initially for a while or even a long period of time before they get to you by somebody else. Are there any, I'm not going to say common errors, but things that you see people doing both in management of localized and metastatic disease? Let's just say that it's different than what you and most GI investigators do.
It's a broad question. I think that generally speaking, my experience with seeing community oncologists treat pancreatic cancer is that they're doing a pretty good job. And I give them credit for treating, you know, 3 to 5 pancreatic cancers a year in the midst of, you know, 100 breast cancer patients and lung cancer patients, et cetera, et cetera. I think the knowledge on how to use FOLFIRINOX and how to use gemcitabine and nab-paclitaxel has disseminated pretty well across the community, and they care for these patients and they manage these patients pretty well. There are just subtleties that I would say in terms of how we manage these patients. We tend to be a little bit more aggressive in the supportive care for FOLFIRINOX, often adding IV fluid periodically during the course of their 2-week therapy. We're a little more subtle in the way we make dose adjustments. But those are really just, again, subtleties, not really black and white issues where I see anything being done terribly wrong in the community. The one big change that I have routinely implemented for gemcitabine nab-paclitaxel in the metastatic patients is that gem nab-paclitaxel's standard therapy is 3 weeks on, 1 week off, as published in the IMPACT trial. But there have been a couple of publications that, albeit retrospective looks, but they have clearly shown retrospectively that every other week gem nab-paclitaxel is just as effective and much, much better tolerated than the standard 3-on-1-off. And to be perfectly honest, it's been a couple of years now. I just routinely adopt every other week gem nab-paclitaxel rather than 3 weeks on, 1 week off. And patients do generally tolerate much, much better. The only scenario where I haven't completely adopted that are for patients who have potentially curable, like we're giving them neoadjuvant preoperative gem nab-paclitaxel. I do try and stick to the standard 3-on-1-off, just because I don't have any data necessarily one way or the other, but I don't want to compromise their potential for being able to get to surgery.
I'm curious also, you know, we've talked a lot in the last couple of years about NALIRI 5-FU as a second line or beyond therapy. Do you utilize it? Do you see docs in practice utilizing it? And do you think it's a valuable strategy?
I do see docs in practice use it. Actually, ironically, I see less use in the academic setting because I think the criticism, which is fair, is that NALIRI 5-FU has never been proven to be better than FOLFIRI. And if you look at second-line studies that have used FOLFIRI as an arm, the survival's about the same as in the NAPOLI-1 NALIRI study. It would be great, it'll probably never happen, but it would be great to have a head-to-head NALIRI 5-FU versus FOLFIRI study. And so I think part of the reason that you see more use of it in the community is because it is part of the algorithm. It is FDA-approved as second-line therapy for pancreatic cancer. And so they are definitely following the guidelines to the T by using NALIRI 5-FU. In my practice, I actually, in all honesty, when it first came out, I didn't choose to use it because I said I might as well just use FOLFIRI. But I've been influenced by the notion that it is an FDA-approved second-line standard regimen, and I think probably we should stick to that ideally.
I want to talk a little bit about localized disease, but one more question in terms of metastatic disease. Again, you know, Monday morning quarterbacking, it's always interesting to compare what you might do and other people might do. We've talked about selection of therapy. What about in terms of supportive care of the patient with advanced pancreatic cancer? Any sort of clinical pearls or things that you've learned about taking care of these patients that, you know, maybe would be useful to share?
The first thing that comes to mind for sure is a dietitian. The nutritional support that dietitians provide for pancreatic cancers is invaluable. And our dietitians really do a great job helping these patients learn how to manage the cachexia and the lack of appetite that comes from the cancer itself and then also from the chemotherapy. I know that they're a valuable resource and many centers don't have access, but if you have access to a nutritionist, a pancreatic cancer patient would really benefit from that. And there are even online strategies and support groups, and even like the Pancreatic Cancer Action Network does do some nutritional guidance as well. So even remote access to this support is valuable. I also think that pain control in a palliative care program is very valuable. This has not been proven in pancreatic cancer, but in lung cancer, we know that there's proof that implementing palliative care concurrently with initiating systemic therapy actually leads to an improved overall survival. I think patients are a little bit afraid when they hear us talk about palliative care. They think we're relegating them to hospice. And in fact, ironically, one of my things is I fight very hard against the cynicism that's out there for pancreatic cancer. And I hate it when patients do get relegated to hospice at first diagnosis. But I do also think that getting a palliative care team involved and helping with their supportive care can be very, very valuable. More and more, my experience in the places I've been to, I don't know if this is universal across the country, more and more hospice organizations are branching off part of their practice that actually allows patients to get a lot of the supportive care services that hospice provides, but without calling it end-of-life care, without forcing them to be off chemotherapy.
Yeah, I know. I think Philip was telling me they have a program, but they call it supportive care rather than palliative care. So I think maybe a lot of it is a little bit in the name. You mentioned pain as an issue. Again, any pearls, any things that you've come up with at MD Anderson in terms of pain control?
I think we have a very aggressive pain management service. Of course, celiac blocks are important. They don't always work, but it's certainly worth a try for that patient that has pain. For the patients that don't benefit from a celiac plexus block, radiation therapy as a palliative measure, particularly short course radiation, like with SBRT, stereotactic radiation, can often provide palliative benefit as well. And again, I think close management and different strategies to try and discern what the cause of the pain. There's a difference between the pain of a tumor sitting in the retroperitoneum and hurting the nerves versus the pain that the cancer is causing with the GI discomfort and the cramping and everything else because of the pancreatic enzyme insufficiency.
So actually, I was just flashing on the fact that in our studio in Miami, we had 6 general medical oncologists who came from across the country. And we just said, what do you want to learn more about? What would you like us as a CME group to cover? And the number one thing that they brought up to us, which really surprised me, was, what do I say to the patient who says, should I use medical marijuana and how do I use it? Is that an issue? Do you recommend that in your patients?
I don't know if I'm going to get in trouble here at all, but I recommend it universally because in my experience, basically every patient, I had one 90-year-old gentleman who was a complete teetotaler, had never touched any alcohol or drugs, and he just didn't like how the marijuana made him feel. But with the exception of that one patient, every other patient that I've had who had access to, legally or illegally, in all honesty, had access to medical marijuana, did great. Decreased nausea, decreased pain, better sense of well-being. So I would never recommend that these patients get access illegally, of course, but if there are programs that allow for access to medical marijuana, I definitely encourage them to use it.
Well, what they wanted to know is more granularity about like what to say, like how to use it, and what situations does it work better? Do you have any kind of feel for that?
Yeah, that's been a little bit tougher because where I came from back in Maryland and D.C., as you know, it was legal there, and we actually had fairly aggressive medical marijuana programs. So I didn't prescribe medical marijuana. I referred them to these clinics, and they sat down with the doc there and really talked through all the options. I will share my just anecdotal experiences, which is that patients seem to do better with edibles and or with the actual product, like they bake into food and that kind of thing. So again, edibles. And in my purely anecdotal experience, things like the CBD oil did not work all that well.
Interesting. So I want to talk about neoadjuvant therapy because we get a lot of questions about that. And I wanted to hear about one of your cases. But just to finish out, though, we've talked about a bunch of issues related to metastatic disease. A couple sort of basic questions I'm curious about. A simple question, and it's been out there for quite a while, but just to sort of take the pulse, how do you approach the decision about first-line therapy, you know, FOLFIRINOX versus NAB-GEM?
For localized disease?
No, for metastatic disease.
Oh, for metastatic disease. I think it's a patient-by-patient determination. I mean, I do try and stick to the idea that FOLFIRINOX has only been studied in patients up to 80 years old now, so anybody over 80 years old, I do reflexively use GEM-NAB-PAC. But it's really a performance status issue. If the patients seem robust enough and their performance status seems good enough, then I will often use FOLFIRINOX. If not, then I'll use GEM-NAB-Paclitaxel. The other issue is that for some of these patients, we do have clinical trials that are available. And for the last 6, 7, 8 years, the majority of clinical trials for first-line therapy have been GEM-NAB-PAC-based, just because it's a slightly better tolerated regimen and companies are more eager to add their drug onto that regimen. There are now a couple of trials that are coming down the pipeline that are FOLFIRINOX-based, which gives us, again, additional options for these patients. In all honesty, what I tell patients is that we have two regimens. We have five drugs that we use, GEM-NAB-PAC and FOLFIRINOX. And we just need to make sure that they get all of those drugs somewhere during the course of their pancreatic cancer lifetime. And if you remember the 2004 Turnagain study in colorectal cancer that was comparing FOLFOX versus FOLFIRI, they found no difference in the two, but they found that if they sequence one and then the other, that they actually had the best survival times at that time back in 2004 for colorectal cancer. And we see the same in pancreatic cancer. If you go FOLFIRINOX followed by GEM-NAB-PAC or GEM-NAB-PAC followed by some 5-FU-based regimen, FOLFIRINOX or otherwise, that those patients actually have the best survival times.
So again, before we get to neoadjuvant therapy, just to touch base about adjuvant therapy, where you are today with that decision and selection of therapy.
I have to sort of stand on a soapbox a little bit and say that FOLFIRINOX should really be the standard of care because of the evidence that came out a year ago in 2018. You know, we had the best outcomes essentially ever in adjuvant therapy with FOLFIRINOX. It was a well-selected patient population with a CA19-9 going into the operation of less than 180, but nevertheless, you know, a 54-month median overall survival is remarkable in the resected patient population. I thought that we were going to see similar data come for GEM-NAB-PAC, and so I was pretty disappointed by the presentation, the results of the APAC study that did not show a statistically significant improvement in their primary endpoint of progression-free survival. There's a lot of nuances to the study and to the presentation, and I think, you know, Margaret Tempero did a great job really trying to tease out what we learned from that study. But at the end of the day, it was a negative study. And I think if the patients can tolerate FOLFIRINOX, I'm using FOLFIRINOX. For the patient who clearly can't tolerate FOLFIRINOX, I'm sticking with the other level one evidence that we have, which is gemcitabine, capecitabine.
What's your explanation for why GemNab didn't seem to work in the adjuvant setting?
I don't know. I think there's a lot of theories out there. I think that there could be some argument that not every regimen that works in the metastatic setting necessarily works in the adjuvant setting. We know this with irinotecan for colorectal cancer. I certainly wish it had been a positive study. It was a well-done study. You know, maybe they could have done different statistics and maybe the overall survival benefit would have proven out to be real. But, you know, that's sort of second-guessing retrospectively.
So I want to finish out talking about neoadjuvant therapy, and I'd like to hear about your 56-year-old lady.
Yeah, so she's a pretty classic patient that presents, again, with painless jaundice, and she was fortunate to have non-metastatic disease, which, as you know, probably is at best about 40% of patients with any degree of localized involvement, and really only about 5% who have truly borderline resectable disease. Now, 5, 6, 7 years ago, it was really important to discern, to tease out truly operable with no arterial involvement versus borderline resectable where there's less than 180 degree arterial involvement versus locally advanced unresectable patients. And that was because it was thought at that time, at least it certainly was true with gemcitabine, that there was no benefit, that no locally advanced pancreatic cancer patient was ever going to get to the operating room because their tumors never became rendered operable. I think those lines have blurred significantly. And there's one prospective study with GemNab paclitaxel called the LAPAC study, and then several large retrospective case series with FOLFIRINOX in clearly defined, well-defined, locally advanced, unresectable patients, and about 15% of those patients, so not the majority by any means, but some of those patients do become rendered operable with R0 resections. And that's why the lines have really become blurred. The borderline resectable patients, we definitely treat with neoadjuvant therapy. MD Anderson, in many ways, led the field and other institutions in saying that we should be treating all patients, even the clearly operable patients, with neoadjuvant chemotherapy because of this idea that pancreatic cancer becomes micrometastatic so early, so we want to kill the microscopic seeds first before we take them to surgery. And I definitely believe in that mantra. Now, the risk for the patients who get neoadjuvant therapy is that they never make it to the operating room. In the multiple studies that have been done, it's about 30% of patients that don't make it to the operating room. Most of those patients have progressive disease while on chemotherapy and probably are being selected out for by their very bad biology of their cancer. But there are a small percentage of them actually that don't make it to the operating room because they get too sick with chemotherapy. In general, our approach has definitely been to give neoadjuvant therapy for essentially all patients with localized cancer, whether operable, borderline resectable, or locally advanced unresectable.
So what happened with this patient?
So this patient actually did great with FOLFIRINOX, responded robustly. There's a debate on whether we should or should not use chemoradiation post-induction chemotherapy, and we make a case-by-case decision based on the extent of the tumor that's there. And so this patient actually is currently getting chemoradiation with capecitabine and radiation, and then the plan is to be able to go on to have surgery hopefully in a few weeks.
Chemoradiation and then surgery. If I present that case to 25 GI investigators, is generally that's the way they're going to approach it?
No, you're probably going to get, you won't get 25 answers, but you'll probably get 3 or 4 different groups because we just don't know. We just don't know whether we should or should not be giving radiation to these patients in the preoperative setting and even the kind of radiation we should be given because there's standard radiation and sometimes the decision is made to give 50 gray versus 30 gray standard radiation. There's stereotactic radiation. At my prior institution, we gave all of these patients stereotactic radiation. And at some centers, they're even using proton radiation for these neoadjuvant patients. So unfortunately, we really don't know, and really well-done studies are difficult to really get organized. Now, there was one important study led by Matt Katz at my institution of neoadjuvant FOLFIRINOX for truly defined borderline resectable pancreatic cancer patients. And the trial was FOLFIRINOX versus FOLFIRINOX plus a course of stereotactic radiation. And while the results of the trial aren't definitively known, what we do know is that the SBRT arm was shut down early because apparently more of those patients were having R1 resections or not getting to resection. So it definitely gave some pause as to the value of radiation in that patient population.
Just kind of curious, we were talking before about PARP inhibitors. if you had a patient, let's say, who had a resectable cancer, or maybe you gave them neoadjuvant therapy and then they were resected, and you found out that they had, let's say, a BRCA germline mutation. First of all, are there any trials of PARP inhibitors in either the neoadjuvant or adjuvant setting? Any situations where you consider off-label use of a PARP inhibitor?
So there are no neoadjuvant trials that I know of. One of my colleagues, Kim Reisbinder, again, she's been trying to get the cooperative group, because it would take a cooperative group to do a study like that, but we've been trying to get the cooperative group to approve an adjuvant study. I think it's a great idea to look at a PARP inhibitor after adjuvant therapy and see if it achieves sort of long-term control of the disease. Because these drugs do have toxicities, I have not been using it off-label for this patient population.
So, yeah, there's a big breast study that's cooking and hasn't reported yet in the adjuvant situation. Obviously, an ovary, I would call that adjuvant therapy, what people are doing. So it's certainly a logical thought and maybe a tempting thought, but your thoughts are well taken.
Yeah, when we've tried to justify the pancreas trial, we've used the ovarian cancer data as our model.
Right, and now, I mean, it looks like it's maybe going to become part of adjuvant therapy regardless of genomic status, the way it sort of did with ovary with platinum-sensitive relapse. Anything that we haven't talked about in terms of pancreatic cancer that you want to make a comment on?
I think talking about clinical trial strategies, and I think when to refer patients to clinical trials, I think that's an important point both for academics and community oncologists. Clinical trials in the refractory for refractory setting, the so-called third-line setting, really is not a strategy that works. Many of these patients are sick. They don't do particularly well, and we just don't get a good scientific, let alone clinical, readout for this patient population. This is, again, why I really like the maintenance setting. So the patients who've been responding to frontline therapy for metastatic disease and actually are doing well, I think that's the time to refer them to clinical trials, because either you're teeing them up for an interesting second-line study, or some of the strategies, and we're certainly building some of those at my institution, some of the strategies are specifically designed for the maintenance setting where patients are overall doing well, can go through a couple of serial biopsies if we have to, and ultimately that's the best place to test these patients.